March 26, 1987. National Council of Jewish Women, Chuck Coffey and Marcia Ripp interviewing Bernice Prizer at her home on Wallingford Street. And I'm just going to say Wallingford Street, Pittsburgh 15213. Bernice Prizer, you said that you were born in Pittsburgh?
That's correct, in Mount Oliver.
In Mount Oliver. So have you always lived here?
Yes. Well, no. Oh, no, indeed. When I left college, I lived in New York for 2 years, then came back here for 4 years, and then went out to Los Angeles and lived out there for almost 11 years. And I've been back in Pittsburgh since... I think it was 1955, somewhere around in there.
Now, who was your father? You told us that
your father was Maury Goldman. He was general manager of his last job was general manager Hughes and Hatcher in Pittsburgh.
And your mother?
My mother was Ethel Rosenstein Goldman, who was born in Cleveland, but spent most of her young life in New York City until she married my father. And they lived here in Pittsburgh together for 62 years.
That's a record. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have an older brother, Stanley Goldman, who lives in, at the moment on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And a younger brother, Lee Goldman, who is at Riverview.
Tell me a little bit about your early childhood. Was there anything outstanding? In other words, I'm looking for things that made you such a prominent woman in the area. Is there anything that you can think about?
I think probably the thing that motivated me was that I had an older brother who was so outstanding and excelled in everything he did that I really put myself in competition with him at a very early age. He's 4 years older than I am, and I used to resent the fact that he was so good at everything, but I think it put me on my mettle to try to be better at certain things in order to outdo him. It was really sibling rivalry that inspired me, I think, more than anything.
Are you talking about intellectually and athletically?
No, I'm talking about intellectually, primarily, because he was, well, when he graduated from Taylor Alderdice, he was president of the first graduating class. He was a senior and I was a freshman. He was national he was city tennis champion, national oratorical champion, straight A student, and as handsome as Cary Grant. So it was very hard for me to overcome being Stanley Goldman's sister throughout most of my high school career. And I resented it and vowed that I was going to find some way to outdo him somewhere along the way. And singing was what I did best in high school, and I did fairly well at it and wanted to be an opera singer, as a matter of fact. And that was one place where I excelled that he did not. He didn't sing. Played the piano very well, however.
Did you take formal lessons in
singing? Yes, I took voice lessons all through high school. When I left college and went to New York, I went with the purpose of making a career in music. But I didn't make it.
Your parents encouraged you in this competitive spirit?
They encouraged me in the competitive spirit. They wanted me to be a very good student, which I was not. I was a reasonably good student in English, but in everything else, particularly scientific and math, I was dreadful. And also resentful that I had to do it. It seemed to me like a waste of time. All I want to do is music. They encouraged me in that, but they discouraged me. In those days, it was not considered very nice to try to go on stage. And so they did really not encourage me to be a singer at all, but they allowed me to do it, and they paid for my lessons. But they didn't really want me to do it.
From whom did you take lessons in Pittsburgh?
I can't remember his name. He was a German man who had an office in the old Nixon Theater building when it was the Alcoa building, where the Alcoa building is now. And he was on the second floor in that building. He was a German. He had a square head, and he really looked very Teutonic. And he was very tough with me. And I took lessons with him for a couple of years. And then when I was in New York, the sister of a classmate of mine at Pitt, a woman by the name of Luba Shapiro, gave me lessons. Now, she happened to be she was really a coach, a vocal coach. She happened to be Risa Stevens' coach. And she would coach me on Sundays because I worked during the week, and she would coach me on Sundays, and I would follow Risa Stevens in class, and I would listen to her sing. And after a few lessons of listening to Risa Stevens, I realized that I was never going to be an opera singer, because she was so much better than I, that I realized at that point that I probably wasn't going to make it.
Were you devastated when you came to this conclusion?
Well, I was devastated, but I felt that I could fall back on going into, that I was good enough to go into musical comedy, that kind of thing,
uh-huh.
So that I felt, well, I'd never make it in opera, but I might possibly make it in musical comedy.
Now, you went from Alderdice to Pitt?
Yes.
And you graduated from Pitt?
I left Pitt, I mean, I consider myself the oldest living dropout. I left Pitt in the middle of my junior year and went to New York. I just thought I was wasting my time. I had wanted to go to Carnegie Tech to study music, and because I had such terrible grades in math, and in those days, even to be a singer, you had to be a mathematician at Carnegie Mellon, or Carnegie Tech at that time. And I couldn't get in. And so I went to Pitt just because I had to go to college. And it was something my parents wanted me to do, whether I wanted to do it or not. And so I went and just kept saying, I don't want to go back, I don't want to go back. And finally, in the middle of my junior year, my brother said to me, if you want to go to New York, I'll help you financially to go. He was by that time working as advertising director of Kaufman, and he urged me to do what I wanted to do, and he helped me financially as well as my parents, who at that time, in the middle of 1938, were there. There's not a lot of money around, as everyone knows, I think, and my parents couldn't afford to send me to New York. They bought me my clothes and they helped me when they could. And my brother helped me, had probably the magnificent salary of $25 or $30 a week. And he sent me 10 of it. So, and I worked in New York. And
talk about your New York trip, you mentioned that while you were taking lessons while you were at Pitt, you were working even then.
No, I didn't work at Pitt when I was a kid.
You didn't work when you were at Pitt.
No.
You said you were taking lessons on Sunday because you were...
No, that was in New York.
Oh, that was in New York.
Yeah,
okay.
So Luba Shapiro was my New York teacher.
All right. So you get yourself to New York without a job.
I got myself to New York without a job. And I was there for 3 months. And my parents said, come home and learn how to do something. And we'll allow you to go back to New York. So they suggested I learn typing and shorthand, and I went to our old friend Dorothy Finkelhor, and Dorothy put me into what was then, I guess, her training college. I forget the name of it.
BTC.
And I took a 3-month course in typing and shorthand. And I when I finished, Dorothy offered me a job as a teacher or as a salesperson for her. And I said, no, 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 I don't want to stay. I want to go back to New York. And she said, all right, we'll get you a job. Maybe that'll take you to New York. So she helped me to get a job with an advertising agency that was moving its office to New York.
What was the name of the agency?
I was only there 3 months. And they took me to New York, and that was, they were a unique kind of agency. It's the kind of agency I would never, under ordinary circumstances, work for. It was called a syndicated advertising agency. They had a thousand names. One of them was Anderson Hall, another one was... They had about 20 names on the door. They changed the name every time they sold a new campaign. It's too long a story to tell you how they operated. I don't mean that it was dishonest.
No, I understand. Conflict of interest or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. So they used to change their names and keep the names on the door. It was a strange kind of operation. But they were moving to New York, and I went with them, and I answered the telephone, and I did the typing. And after about 3 months, I asked the copy chief in the agency to show me what it was he did. And in the meantime, my brother was a copywriter, which is a strange thing since I was always competing with him. But I had my best courses had always been in English. And I liked music and radio, and I was imaginative, so I thought that was advertising and writing might be a good thing to do until I became a singer. And I learned how to write some copy, and through a friend of mine, managed to get a job on Madison Avenue in the real advertising world as a copywriter. And I spent 2 years with that agency writing for the Emily shops and the fashion hosiery shops and Selby shoes and that kind of, those Fifth Avenue shops that were in existence between 1938 and 1940.
What was the name of that agency?
And that agency was Morton Hall. Morton Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, Morton Freund Agency. Very small, there were only 8 people in the agency. And around the middle of 1940, my brother came to New York and said that he was leaving Kaufman's and he was going to open his own advertising agency in Pittsburgh. If I was interested in coming home, the two of us could go into business together. Well, by that time, I was ready to come home, and I came home and worked for my brother. He and I together, I was the inside person. I did all the typing, wrote all the radio copy, and swept the floors and so on and so forth. I kept the books, and he was the external person. He did all the selling, and he wrote all the newspaper ads. And we did very well. We became a very successful retail-oriented advertising agency. The name of the agency was J. Grant Company. My brother thought that Grant was a good old name in Pittsburgh. And since both of us were so young, we ought to have something old on our name. So it was really quite successful. We had Gimbel's, we had Maystern's, we had fashion hosiery shops, we had breakfast cheer coffee. We had a really good list of very excellent accounts, and we did very well. And in the July of 1942, my brother was called, he volunteered for the Navy. He was by that time married and had a 3-month-old baby, but he volunteered for the Navy and was accepted in officer's training school in July of 1942. And he turned over the agency to me. I was in my early 20s and was now going to be responsible for this big operation. And he hired a man to front for me, really, a man who would be over age so he wouldn't be drafted and likely to go to war. And the two of us together ran the agency. I put money in the bank for my brother, and put his salary in the bank every week, and worked very hard, seven days a week sometimes. And we kept all of our clients and kept on going. And around the end of April, or end of 1944, I think it was, I got a letter from my brother, and he said that he didn't think he was going to come back to Pittsburgh after the war. He thought he would go to New York and work in New York in an agency there. So by that time, I had had a number of friends go to Los Angeles, one close friend in particular. And so I decided, he said, I decided to sell the agency to the man, this Mr. Neiplin, N-E-I-P-L-I-N, who was the man I mentioned earlier. I sold the business to him, and I went to Los Angeles. As I mentioned earlier, we had a Gimbel's as a client, and the president of Gimbel's at that time was Jack Blum.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Blum wrote a letter for me to Tom May of the May Company. He was at that time president of the May Company in Los Angeles. And I had an idea for a radio program, a morning shopping program, similar to the kind that Florence Sandow did for Kaufman's, you may recall that. And I went out there and I sold the May Company on the idea of doing the radio program. And they asked me to do it myself, so that was now I was into show business at long last. In a slightly different way than I had planned. And I did that program 5 mornings a week. And then on Friday afternoon, I did a special program on consumerism. It was a little bit ahead of its time, showing people how to test. We tested merchandise and so on. And then on Sundays, I did a fashion show on television. It was the first department store use of television in the country. And we did a fashion show from the Ambassador Hotel pool every Sunday. So I did all of that for 3 years. In the meantime, I met the man who became my husband, and I was married in 1947, and in July of 1948, my son was born. And at the time that my son was born, happens to be my only child, went to my boss, who was a woman. A woman by the name of Frances Corey, who was a wonderful woman, and said to her, "I'm going to retire. I'm never going to work again. I've been working for 10 years. I've been working since I'm 19. I'm going to now stop working and be a mother and a wife and live like everybody else as I'm tired of working." She said to me, "You know, I'm a mother and a wife." But she said, "But you're very much like me, and you will be bored. I urge you not to stop." And I said, "Oh, no, no, I've made up my mind." She said, "I'll put a line into your house. You can do your program, your radio program from home until you're able to come back to work." And I said, "No, I'm never going to work again." And she said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Yes, I've made up my mind." So I trained my successor, and fortunately, radio being what it is, I could work until about the eighth month, and I finally went home and had the baby the end of July. 104 degrees, in the San Fernando Valley in July and no air conditioning. And but I don't know how I survived it, but somehow or other we did in those days. I went home and I had the baby, and 3 months later I was climbing the wall. And I was dying to go back to work. And so I did freelance writing at home. The radio program was gone to me, but I did freelance copywriting at home.
For until my retailers or what?
Retailers, small agencies. The agency that had handled the May Company, I did a lot of May Company writing, as a matter of fact, for them, some of the radio commercials and so forth. And my husband went overseas on a job. He was in the public relations at one of the movie studios. He was at Paramount Pictures. No, MGM at that time. And he went overseas to do a PR for a big film. I can't remember which that was. But he went overseas for... Oh, he was gone almost a year while the baby was just a year old. And of course, it made it even more boring for me. I was ready to lose my mind by the time he came back. And and when the baby was two, I put him in a nursery school and went to work for the agency that handled the May Company.
Do you remember the name of that one?
Bernie Weinberg. And I worked for him for about a year and a half. And then I got a job with a big agency called Wade Advertising. I don't know that they're still in business. But they were very big at that time, and they handled the Alka-Seltzer account. They had a Chicago office and a Los Angeles office. And the Los Angeles office was responsible for all radio and television. And so I got a great deal of experience writing for television at that time, way ahead of anybody else except those people who happened to be in New York or Los Angeles, because that's the only place television was at that time. And I did a lot of writing for the Alka-Seltzer account. In 1954, my husband died, and I felt that I did not want to raise a child in Hollywood. We lived in the movie milieu. Our friends were writers and directors and some actors and so on, and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law were in the business. And my sister-in-law was June Pricer. I don't know if you remember little June Pricer. She was a blonde dancer who was in some of the Andy Hardy movies. She was the little girl next door. She was in Strike Up the Band. She was a little acrobatic dancer. But anyway, I just felt it was, being alone, it was no place to raise a child. The sense of values out there were not mine. And so I was glad to come back to this. And I came back in late 1954. And my mother and father were at that time living at the Carlton House. The Carlton House had just opened. They were among the first tenants. And I got a job I stayed at the Carlton House. And got a job with Bob Lando. Happened to be riding up and down the elevator one day and bumped into him, and he'd been a friend of mine in college, or not in college, in high school. And he asked me what I was doing. He had started an advertising agency. He was down in the basement of the Carlton House. And I thought that would be a very convenient place to have a job. I put my son in Falk School. And it was September. We had come back right on Labor Day. And so he had to start the next day in school, and I talked my way into, and he he talked his way into getting into Falk because he appeared to be so self-assured. He'd been in nursery schools and in day schools all his life, you know, so he was, nothing fazed him. He wasn't at least at all shocked by being in Pittsburgh or by being in a new school, and they were so impressed with that, they let him in without testing him, and said they'd test him later. So anyway, I got him into school, and I went to work for Lando. Bob Lando, we had a small agency. He had about, maybe 12 to 15 people at that time. But he had never worked in any other agency. He just opened it. And his two partners, also had never worked in an agency. So what he wanted of me was to sort of give him my experience, set him up in, as his administrative assistant, set him up in business and show him how I had operated before and show him how other agencies, big agencies, operate, and which I did. But he really had no place for me. He gave me a very small salary, but I enjoyed it. I loved it. But he had no place for me, and about a year after I'd worked for him, I got a call from Ketchum, McLeod & Grove, which is the city's largest advertising agency, and that they're now called Ketchum Incorporated. And they wanted me to come to as a senior copywriter on the Alcoa Wrap account, which they had just gotten. And they knew that I had what you call packaged goods experience, having worked it on the Alka-Seltzer account. And I was one of the few people that had television experience with that. So they wanted me very badly. And I said, no, I was just happy with what I was doing. And when they finally tripled my salary, I very reluctantly left. In fact, I went to Bob and said, I don't want to leave, but I do have this child, and I do have to pay for his tuition. And so, and I said, and I want to get an apartment, and so on and so forth. I don't want to live at home forever. So I, in the meantime, my parents moved to this house. And we all lived here for about 3 years. Anyway, I got this job at Ketchum. And after a year, there were two women in the copy department, what's called the creative department, and there were no women, none whatsoever, in the merchandise marketing department or in what they call the administrative offices, the account executives. There were no men. There were 200 men, and maybe 50 secretaries or 25 secretaries, all women. And then the two women copywriters in that agency when I joined them in 1956. And so they asked me to become an account executive on the Rubbermaid products account. And although I didn't want to do it, I was really very happy doing this creative work. I wasn't really interested in being an administrator. I did it because they told me that was the only place I would make a lot of money. My boss convinced me to do it, and he said, also, you'll get stock in the company, and you'll be the only woman. And so I took the job, and I became a supervisor, and then director of consumer marketing in the 7 years that I was there. But there were still no women, no other women in the agency. It was disgraceful. And after I'd been there 7 years, one of Bob Lando's partners had a heart attack and had to retire. And Bob called me and said, I'm not going to talk to anyone else. Will you come back here as vice president and head of our consumer division? By that time, he had grown to about 60 people. And while it was a much smaller agency, I felt that I would have control over it and I felt always, even though I had worked my way up to a fairly responsible position as catcher, all I had to do was look around to know that women were not going to go very far in that organization. And so I was just waiting for the opportunity to go back to Lando, to tell you the truth. My friends were there, and I enjoyed it immensely. And I was one of maybe two Jews at Ketchum as well, and ran into an enormous amount of anti-Semitism.
All right, we're going to turn over now and talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you, before I forget, I wanted your husband's full name.
Thomas Edward Pricer.
Stop it, even if there's a little time left.